hopefully, you know, we all grow every day. We learn from our mistakes, absorb, digest, and just keep moving. So it just can't be about, can't just fixate it on a particular job.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tarun Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with property investor and buyer's advocate at Property Magnate Consulting, Pradeep Lakshmanara. We delve into his background from growing up in India and Nigeria to traveling to Australia, what life was like after moving to Australia, the amazing story of his first investment property, and much, much more. Lakshmanara shares a little bit of his background and what work he is going on in his life at the moment.
Originally, I come from India, and I'm in IT. I also do a bit of part-time print modeling, short films, and my core business, my core passion is being a buyer's advocate for my customers. My own business is, the name of the business is Property Magnate Consulting, and that's where my passion is.
He has more going on than just property, and we learn about his mindset behind juggling all of them at once.
You live once, and if you have different passions, and as far as you know, you're not hurting anyone, and you're fulfilling it, then have a go. Break that ceiling, break that threshold, and just pursue everything you can. And as far as you enjoy it, so I quite enjoy it. I enjoy my work in IT. I enjoy my short film making, and absolutely passionate about property, because that just gives us that what I call financial independence, or financial buffering, if you like, to be able to pursue your different passions.
We find out what a typical day for Lakshmanara looks like and how his team is able to help their clients when it comes to property.
The kind of customers that I actually help is people who are, from first-time buyers to investors, people generally who have the fear of overpaying for properties, perhaps not knowing where to start, how to go about researching about properties.
He talks to us about his background, and we learn about where he grew up and how that upbringing has helped him.
I actually grew up across two countries. So originally I'm from India. I spent a good time of my life there. We then went to Nigeria, Africa. I spent, close to 10 years there in the country. And then the next one third is in Australia. So I'm not sure where the next one third is going to be, but it's, my life so far has been split across three countries. So I think travel has helped me quite a bit in terms of, tolerance and appreciating different cultures and people. So that's really, really been helpful.
Spending his childhood across two countries on different continents, he learned about what he wanted in his future.
My schooling has been across two countries, so India as well as Africa, West Africa, Nigeria. And, school was good. I think my parents, especially my mother, she didn't want to put me somewhere very far. So the school was really as close to home, walkable distance, if you like. And middle-class family, nothing out of the ordinary or extravagant, but we had a decent middle-class family. Parents worked very hard, obviously, to give us the basics, food, clothing, shelter, and ensure that there was no shortage of anything. But I was always intrigued towards, I just thought there's more to life than just going to work 9 to 5, and, there has to be something more to this. And I always thought about, how do we go up out of our way, out of the box, and create that journey or that pathway towards success, whatever that might be, because again, that's a very subjective thing to every human being. So, I just thought the traditional way, schooling, college, and then go to work 9 to 5, that's okay. But surely, we could be entrepreneurial in our individual journeys and create that financial freedom.
Lakshmanara tells us the amazing story about how his family eventually transitioned from living in India to moving to Nigeria.
My dad got an opportunity to work in Nigeria. So he, at that stage, said, look, I've got to take this opportunity to provide a better life for myself and my family. So he went there, my mother, my sisters, myself, we went there. You know, we stayed there for a few years, I think close to a decade, almost 10 years. And I think, you know, we came back, you know, when I was probably around 14, 15, I think I came back to the country, back to India. Yeah, but it was more to provide a better, you know, better life for the family. And my father continued to work there as well for a few more years, even after we came. So that's the sacrifice he had to make, you know. He said, you know, he sent us back, my mom, my sisters and myself, back to India, and he stayed there. And it always stayed in my mind that, you know, we, you know, the parents always go above and beyond for their kids and the family, you know. I'm a father now, you know, and I've got my wife, and you could imagine if I got separated from my wife and kids and lived in another state, I mean, let alone on the country, to provide a better life. It's just, the, you know, most what middle-class families do, Tehran, to provide for a better life. So that's all, that always stayed with me, you know, that always thought, you know, I would want to, hopefully, you know, they worked so hard to establish a foundation for me. Hopefully I could use that and do something better.
Being apart from a parent at that age was extremely difficult for him. And we find out about how often he was able to see his father when they were living in different countries.
Back in those days, he was coming once in 2 years, you know, because it was tough for him as well. You know, you couldn't, we would try and make it an annual kind of a thing, annual trip. But at times, and back in those days, you know, we didn't have the internet or the, you know, mobile phones, if you like. So it used to be, we used to call it a trunk call, an international call. And an international call called as a trunk call was a big thing, you know. A, was expensive. B, you had to call perhaps the neighbors or someone, and then you could go and, you know, get the phone from there. And look, it was definitely not easy. And I think I appreciate and respect the sacrifice he made, my mother made, so that we as kids could have, you know, a decent middle-class life, you know, with the basics. So, you know, at a very early age, you realize that the world is very competitive, Tehran. You know, it's a competitive world. Yes, it's extremely materialistic as well. You got to live, you got to pay your bills, you got to work. And I always thought, that's great, but what if you created that financial freedom sooner than expected? There surely must be a way to create that financial freedom to be able to achieve whatever you want to achieve rather than wait till your late 50s or 60s. We meet people, grow individually. You know, I think we all grow, right? You know, hopefully, you know, we all grow every day. We learn from our mistakes, absorb, digest, and just keep moving. So it just can't be about, can't just fixate it on a particular job. Yeah, as you rightly said, we're here. We've got to enjoy life. Enjoy the sun.
He shares more about what he set out to do after high school and some of the sacrifices that needed to be made for him to achieve his goals.
My primary education, as I said, was split between India and Nigeria. Initially, it was in India and then went to Nigeria. And then from Nigeria, we went back to India. So I continued my secondary, you know, we call this college here in Australia, but that was seventh standard back in India, year seven, back again to the roots in India. Did my engineering there as well. And from there, in 2003, I came to Australia as an international student with a loan of $16,000, you know. Now, please put this into context. Back then, there was a lot of money for my family, you know, $16,000 multiplied by 30 rupees, which was the, you know, the conversion rate back then, was a lot of money for us, you know, for my parents. And my father had to take a loan. It was an education loan taken. He said, whatever you do, don't fail. Just pass, because as an international student, not many people are aware. If you do fail, then you've got to pay three times the price per subject. So if something's going for $300, if you do fail, you've got to pay three times the price, like $900, as opposed to who, you know, a normal kid would pay. So the idea was, look, we've got a loan, you know, you've got 3 years. And I still remember him telling me that in the airport. He gave me $3,000 Aussie and $10. I still have the $10. I still kept it. And I keep telling him, showing it to him whenever I meet him. And the key was, don't fail.
And what did you do when you came to Australia to study?
My areas of study was IT, so computer science. But in IT, I've got my bachelor's in computer science engineering. So the idea was I get my master's in IT from La Trobe University. Fortunately, a two-year course was reduced to a one-year master's. A two-year master's was reduced to a one-year master's because of the credits I could gain, I had scored from my previous study, which was great. But having said that, it was still a, you know, I still remember the first day in Australia I arrived, I had my 20 kilos of luggage and I didn't know a single soul, you know. And there was, for me, the longest walk was when the taxi driver dropped me at the campus. And La Trobe University is a massive campus, by the way, in Melbourne. It's a massive campus. So that walk from where he dropped me from the gates till the campus, you know, almost, you know, 1.5 Ks, almost 1.5, 2 Ks, that walk was, you reflect a lot, you know, you're literally carrying your own luggage. There's no one to help you, just by yourself. It's just you, your luggage. You're trying to find, you know, your room. There's a lot of thoughts and emotions in your mind. You don't want to fail. You know, you have education loan. And also, you know, you've got enough money to perhaps last for a month. So you've got to actually find a job. And, you know, we had, as a student, you've got to work 20 hours, you know, 20 hours a week. That was by law. So I think it still is. So, yeah, the goal was to find a job as soon as possible. And unfortunately, I didn't know how to cook. actually, I still don't, by the way. So it was thinking, hang on a second, how do I manage this? How do I manage my finances and get through this? So it was an emotional journey, but I'm glad it happened to me, because I wouldn't be where I am today without that. That was character building for me.
Coming up after the break, we'll delve into Pradeep Leshamanar's journey and how he got started in property.
Surely there could be some alternative ways of, you know, creating income, you know. And I thought, well, one thing that I really like is property.
How he purchased his first investment property.
For me, the critical part was the entry price. You know, if we had secured that property at a right price point, I knew we would do well. And fortunately, you know, fortune favors the brave. I was fortunate enough to turn up at the auction, have the guts to be there, and we secured the property for $200,000.
And that's next. I'm Tarun Shum, and you're listening to Property Investory. We discussed the living conditions that he had to deal with when he first arrived in Australia and how he dealt with it.
I had to find accommodation myself. So when I landed, I was at La Trobe University. My accommodation was for 3 days only. So within 3 days, the idea was I had to find another accommodation. The reason for that being, you know, campuses are expensive. And I only had $3,000. The idea was to, you know, you want to ensure that you quickly go into a shared accommodation where the rentals are cheaper. So the goal was to find something closer to the university as well. You had to study. Remember, you can't fail as well. So you got to find time to ensure you clear your subjects and be attentive and all that. And also find a job, because, you know, you've got to be able to manage your expenses. So I had, you know, A, find an accommodation, B, friend people, the right kind of people, fortunately. Find a job which can pay the bills, so as to speak. So yeah, it was challenging, but you know, you come across all kinds of people, even the ones which are not very helpful. That's okay, you learn from that. You know, you learn from adversity at times, and then you get some lovely people who are go above and beyond to help you. So yeah, I mean, I think one particular incident that stays with me is, I remember when I was, you know, back in those days, I didn't have a mobile phone, you know, so, and the only mobile phone my sister gifted to me, I lost in a tram. So it was like, oh my God, what do I do? So we used to use the international calling cards, Diron. We used to get international calling cards to call India. It used to be valued at $10, which is a big amount of money for me back then. Out of which the connection fee, $2 used to go in connection fee. So all you're left with is $8, and you had like 55 minutes to speak. And I used to use the Telstra booth, the Telstra phone booth, to, you know, put in the card and call my parents. One such time, I think the calling card, you know, got finished and I couldn't complete my conversation with my mother and my father. So I was very upset, and I was sitting on the bench really upset. There was this great Aussie guy who came to, I don't even know the guy. He just comes across and says, hey, you all right, buddy? I said, yeah, I'm all right. You know, this happened that I couldn't speak to my parents. Unfortunately, the money in the calling card got over and I don't have much money left. So I've got to wait for the next month to speak with them. You know, the idea was to call them once in a fortnight or at least once a month. He very kindly took out his mobile phone which was a big luxury back then. I'm talking about 2003, and handed me his phone and said, call your parents. I said, well, sir, this is an international call. It's going to cost you a lot of money. Because that's okay. You go ahead. So for me, what was great about Australia is that, you know, you yes, there are good and bad people everywhere, but you also meet people who are so kind and helpful. You know, this was an absolute stranger, very generous heart, a stranger, you know. So that, you know, really was very inspiring and humbling as well, you know, when you met some lovely people. So, yeah, I thanked him a lot. And obviously, I didn't take up the offer, but I thanked him for his generosity, just that kindness, you know. So, yeah, that's where I knew that, you know, I want to pay it forward, you know. If I ever achieve some degree of success, then it's all about paying it forward, so...
There is a funny story behind the first job that Lashan Manara had when he was still at university.
My first job with university was as a taxi driver. I got fired in 4 hours flat, less than 4 hours flat, because back in those days, we used to get the Melway. You know, the Melway? We never had the GPS. And I'm bad with directions. I'm horrible with directions. And, you know, foreign country, going through a Melway with directions, you know, it was hard. You know, I didn't know that, you know, how can you read maps and go from here to there? I eventually got better at it. But the point is, 4 hours, you know, again, taxi business is a competitive business. You know, as an international student, if you're not quick enough, there's someone else ready to take your job. It's really simple.
Did you have a license already?
Actually, I had my international driver's license, so I could drive. I did have, by the way, all above the board and legally, I did have my international driver's license. So yes, I could drive. But the point is, you know, I was just too slow. And the owner of the taxis, God bless him, he actually said, look, man, you're too slow. You know, you can't be taking 10 minutes to look at a Melway. And rightly so. I understand you're new in the country, but you know, I actually got fired. There was someone else, so I lost that. Then I started washing cars, and I got fired from that as well after a few days because they said, you're too slow. This was the day and age, you know, where you used to wash cars physically, you know, not the machine wash. So, yeah, they said, you're too slow. They still do that. Yes, they do. They do. But these guys are pretty fast enough when I look at it right now, you know, compared to me. I used to be too slow, and they're like, no, you're too slow, you know, you've got to clean everything and you've got to look at the tires and this and that. You're just too slow. So I remember my boss telling me, you curry muncher, you're too slow. So he fired me on the spot and said, oh, okay, I'm so sorry. So I lost that job. Then I was rejected by McDonald's, which was really sad because I'd prepared for it and all that. I just couldn't get through. They said, your English wasn't very good. The feedback was, your English was not very good. We couldn't understand you. Or your accent. So I thought, okay, what do I do now? So I had a few rejections, and I don't know, surprise, surprise, I got a job in a call center, in a telecommunications call center for someone who is, you know, who people said you couldn't speak, well, good English, or we couldn't understand you. I worked in a call center. And I think that was my, I would say, a decent break because, you know, doing all kind of odd jobs, as you say, as a student, that helped me with cash flow. That helped actually me paying for my own expenses, paying for my own rent.
With so much pressure on him to pass his subjects, with the fear of having to pay three times its original cost, we find out whether he passed or failed.
When I did pass, I got with an A grade. So when I did pass and the transcript screen, I was like, wow, this is great. And for my parents, obviously my parents were extremely happy. I still remember my mother was in tears because, you know, it's a big thing back in India. You know, education is a big thing, especially with the big investment and stuff and the sacrifices I've made. So yeah, they were very happy with that. I was very happy, to be honest with you. I don't know how I passed, but I did pass. So I thought, you know, the idea was just to pass, but to score an A grade was just icing on the cake.
We delve into his life after university and what he decided to do after passing his subjects.
I went into workforce. I mean, after the call center gig, that really helped me with my groundwork. I got into different kind of IT jobs, from IT sales to you know, delivery to recruitment to product management to business intelligence and data and finally, I guess, a foot in the door, so as to speak, in the IT world. in the IT industry. And since then, I've, you know, started to do contracting as well, which obviously helped with cash flow. And that helped quite a bit. But perhaps what was missing was, I said, I knew that whilst I enjoyed doing what I did, I was very consumed with work, like we all are. You know, you work, you know, it's we say it's 9 to 5, but it's never 9 to 5, you know, whether you're working for a consulting organization or you're working for an end user, you know, work never ends, work never stops. So I said, well, that's great and I'm enjoying it. That's fantastic. But surely there could be some alternative ways of, you know, creating income, you know. And I thought, well, one thing that I really like is property. That's how my property journey actually started.
During his property investing journey, we find out how he purchased the first property.
We saw a property in Reservoir. The land was 717 square meters, a big parcel of land. It's an old house, obviously, a very old house. So me, you know, my partner and myself, she's my wife right now, but then my girlfriend, who said, well, look, okay, this is a great investment. Let's get it. You know, it's an old house, obviously, pretty old house. But then if you look at the dynamics of the area, you know, it's... 12Ks to Melbourne CBD, you know, the land always appreciates to your own. And I thought, look, there's a lot of drivers for this area. It was near the bus stop. You could walk to the tram station. I did a lot of research. I went and visited the council, the local council. And I said, look, what are your plans for growth for this area? And what's your five-year plan look like? They're very surprised because not many people walk into a council and, you know, ask you about a five-year plan. But I think the more and more I researched the area, the more I realized that, you know, the surrounding areas were at least 40 to 50% more, at least. And this was like literally 5 minutes away, you know, from these suburbs, which were, you know, 40 to 50% more. So I said, look, let's get it. And yeah, we got that property way under market.
What year was that roughly when you got into that particular property?
2003. So the same year, I said, look, you know, we let's take a chance. Yes, we had to pay LMI and all that. But look, back then they were accepting, you know, 5%. Even now they do. But even back then it was probably a bit more lenient. The banks were slightly a bit more lenient, if that made sense. The idea was that, look, we put up a deposit as much as we could. We then use that as a leverage to enter the property market, see how we can create more wealth. Yeah, so that's what I did. So the trade-off, just to let you know, Tyrone, the trade-off back then was, you know, do we pay our education loan or do I pay off the education loan or do I basically buy my first property? And that was a trade-off. It was a massive trade-off. You know, I said, I will keep paying the interest for my $16,000 education loan, but I'll buy this property. And back then there was a lot of resentment as well, you know, and a lot of people, even from family and friends, saying, what are you doing? You know, it's an old property. You've got a very unstable job, if I could put it that way, because, you know, even though I had just got my break, my salary was $22,000, which was not a big amount of money even back then. You know, the idea was for me, the critical part was the entry price. You know, if we had secured that property at a right price point, I knew we would do well. And fortunately, you know, fortune favors the brave. I was fortunate enough to turn up at the auction, have the guts to be there, and we secured the property for $200,000, which, you know, that was exactly what I, you know, I had probably, you know, $15,000 and together with my partner at that stage, now my wife, we were able to pull in that $15,000-$20,000 and we said, look, let's go ahead with it. It was a big decision back then.
Since he was still paying off his education loan and bought his first property in Australia, we delve into how he was able to string together the finances to get the deal done.
In hindsight, when I look back now, I wish I had a team. We could talk about my entry criteria, my exit criteria, my strategy, you know. I wish I had that, you know, that kind of support. I never had that, you see, because I was new in the country. Everything was self-taught. One thing I knew, though, was that this is going to appreciate. This is going to make money. Now, my view at that point in time was that I keep the property for a few years and then sell. At that point in time, that was my strategy. Obviously, I still do have the property, by the way, for the record. I haven't sold that. And it's done very well for me. But back then, as a, you know, 23, 24 year old, that was just my objective was, I want to get in there. I've got a good deal here. Let me get in here. I know I'm paying 5%. I know I'm paying LMI, but you know what? It's still worth it. Let me just get in there and secure this opportunity. Back then, the interest rates were high as well, Tyrone. You know, the interest rates were around 8-9%, which was big. What I did was, my research told me that in Australia, back in the 80s, the interest rates were 16%, 17%. I said to myself, hey, 8-9% is good. Obviously, it's got much better now right now with time. Everything was perhaps subjective to that time, and it was a big commitment. But I took it as a calculated risk. You know, I think just plain risk is silly and stupid. But I said to myself, well, hang on, this is a calculated risk. You know, 8-9%. In the event I can't pay these repayments, I could rent it out as well. So yeah, these were my options at that stage, and I just went ahead with it.
He talked about the amount of research that he did before buying it, and anything else that ensured him that this property was going to make money.
You know, I think for me was the gentrification. I talk about that, the kind of people that were in that community, because you could see that there's a lot of younger crowd getting to that area. You know, so yes, the infrastructure was great. Yes, there were all these schools coming up there and all that kind of stuff. I think schools are a massive driver, you know, especially now I'm a parent. Then I wasn't, but I used to think, hang on a second, should I get married and have kids one day? Obviously, you want to send your kids to the best, you know, the best school that's there, public or private. And there was a lot of that happening back then. You know, there was a lot of good schools coming up. The gentrification side of things, I could see a lot of younger couples coming in to that area. You see, I'd observed that area. You know, I had rented in that area as well, you know, for the first 6 months, 7 months. So I knew what was happening in that area. I would always observe the kind of people coming in trams and trains. And I thought, well, look, long term, this is going to go well. More importantly, Tyrone, the surrounding areas, you know, the reservoir is surrounded by, you know, places like, you know, your Preston is not far from reservoir. Northcote is not far from reservoir. These areas are, right now, they're booming. Even then, they were booming, you know, at that point in time from a price point. But there was this massive difference in price. For example, something going in Preston even back then was going for around, you know, 450, 500. And the very next suburb reservoir was going for 250. That's almost half the price, you know, 250, 300 is almost half the price. So I said to myself, geez, and in terms of the time, it's a 5-minute drive. These suburbs are literally 5 minutes from each other. They're not far. They're actually not far. A few tram stops separate the two, you know. So I thought to myself, man, for an extra 3 or 4 tram stops, that is a lot of money. That's, you know, $200,000 to $300,000 is a lot of money. It's not even a $10,000 or $20,000 difference. You're talking about hundreds and thousands of dollars. So I said to myself, well, look, I've got to give myself a chance here. It is a calculated risk. The other key point was the entry price. Perhaps if the entry price and, again, borrowing capacity, serviceability comes into picture as well. My point was, if I could secure the property around that 220 mark, right, I would be okay.
We continue the conversation on this incredible story of his first property and how he was able to identify it as a profitable investment.
I would still manage to pay the repayment and stuff. Worst case, I could even rent it out. The position of a property was such that it was close to universities as well. So I could rent it out to students as well. All these thoughts were in my mind that should I not be able to service the mortgage, well, I'm going to rent it out, you know, and go renting myself or go with shared accommodation, live in the property as well as, you know, rent out the other rooms. So all these things were playing in my mind. And I thought, I've got to secure this, because what I could see is other investors and other people at that point in time, or my friends and mates, were saying, hey, it's an old property, don't buy there. It's an old property. Absolutely, you know, you're not going to make money. And for me, what I said to myself is, well, the land is massive. I could see development opportunities. I could see, and I had no idea how to go about getting permits. Obviously, now I do, but back then I had no idea. But I thought, hang on, other people are doing it. I could see other people knocking down homes and building townhouses and stuff. Maybe one day will come when I can afford to do that. But I just want to secure this property. So it wasn't just gut feeling. It was just all these data and facts, as I said. Gentrification, the kind of people, the schools. And look, you've got to be realistic. You know, for me, I had to say, can I service the mortgage? Because buying a property is one thing to own. You know, the holding costs, the holding of a property over a period of time is probably the more tougher thing than just buying a property. You know, as you rightly said, there are a lot of people who've lost money in property as well. You know, a lot of people have bought overpriced properties and or even properties and can't even afford the repayments. So yeah, so that was my gut feeling. That were my drivers.
So, inspired by Pradeep Lakshmanara's journey and his amazing story on his first property investment, we'll keep the conversation going in a future episode of Property Invest Story, where we'll discuss his strategy.
Some of the others that I've employed is around cash flow, pure cash flow, because I believe cash is king at the end of the day.
The personal habits which have been contributing to his success.
Despite being an investor for 15 years, you know, I took time and I saw there's a gap there. That's why I formed Property Magnate Consulting. Yeah, certainly my mission is to help 100 people over the next 5 years.
And that's next time in a future episode of Property Invest Story.